the Cortex is actually thousands and thousands of models and all running in parallel, and they're voting all the time. It's a completely different flip in how you think about it.
So do you have it on you? There it is. Okay. So the question is, how often does that thing get washed?
This is Brain Inspired.
Hello, good people. This is Paul Middlebrooks. Just got back from a little bike ride from a coffee shop here in beautiful Durango, Colorado. Oh, it's so nice here. I hope it's beautiful where you are. If you would like to support the show, please go to patreon.com/braininspired or go to my website, braininspired.co, and you can find the red Patreon button there. It was broken last week. Thank you, Matt, for informing me, but it should be working now. Okay, joke of the show, written once again by yours truly. I apologize in advance. So a convolutional neural network walks into a bar. That's it. That's the joke.
Ow! Ow! Thank you!
Little, embodied cognition humor there. All right, I'll keep trying. If you have suggestions for the show, or jokes, please send them my way to paul@braininspired.co. All right, today I talk with Jeff Hawkins. As you'll hear Jeff describe, he's always been interested in neuroscience, and specifically theoretical neuroscience. However, his career veered to computer industry in the 80s, the 1980s that is, when he couldn't convince anyone that theoretical neuroscience was a worthy endeavor. While in the realm of the computer industry, he founded Handspring and Palm Computing of the famed Palm Pilot, which, for those of you youngins out there, was the first widely used handheld computer, otherwise known as a PDA, or Personal Digital Assistant. Fast forward to 2002, still without interest from universities to start a theoretical neuroscience program, Jeff began his own, the Redwood Neuroscience Institute, which has since been subsumed by Berkeley. Shortly after that, he published his excellent and influential book, On Intelligence. And shortly after that, he founded his current company, Numenta, which you'll hear us discuss in a moment. Today, we also discuss his aforementioned book, On Intelligence, which, although it's almost 15 years old now, is clearly still relevant and timely, and I recommend it to all of you. We discuss the role of the theorist in neuroscience. We talk about his new theory, which proposes a fundamental computation performed all across our cortex. Namely, that every cortical column in our cortex models a complete object, and we have thousands of models of objects stored across the entirety of our cortex, all running in parallel. That should make more sense as we discuss it in the show. And we talk a little consciousness and how movement is central to cognition and more. Find the show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/17, or you can just go to numenta.com to find all the papers that lead up to this most recent one that we discuss. Okay, enjoy the show. Jeff Hawkins, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
So I will have given you a pretty lengthy introduction before we're talking right now. But I just want to say here that among the many things that you've done, you invented the Palm Pilot. Now, how long has it been since someone has told you a personal story about using the Palm Pilot?
You'd be surprised how often that happens. It's probably less than a week.
Okay. Well, can I tell you mine just to kick things off?
Sure. Yeah, so, but it's a totally different part of my life. I've completely divorced myself from that. But sure, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it just because you've touched me in many ways, sir. So. So my dad actually bought me a Palm Pilot when I was an undergraduate, and I used it for a while, and then I kind of put it away, and then I started using it when I went to graduate school because you need to be more organized, and so I started using it again. I started dating the woman who is now my wife, and I brought it over to her apartment, and You know, I took it out of my pocket. I put it on the little bar that separated her kitchen and living room. And she's walking around. She walks over and she picks it up and she starts looking at it. And she says, what is this thing? And I was like, it's a Palm Pilot. And I kind of describe what it is. And she's looking at it. Her eyes start to kind of screw up. And she looks over at me and she says, this Palm Pilot smells like trash. And I look over and she's standing with her foot on the trash can pedal with the lid wide open. And she's smelling her own trash, thinking it's the Palm Pilot.
Well, that's an unusual story. I haven't heard one like that before.
Okay, good.
But usually people have stories like, hey, I really enjoyed it, you know?
Well, I did. Actually, you know, one of the funnest things was learning the shortcuts of the handwriting to write the letters. That was really
graffiti,
fun.
Yeah,
the graffiti. That's right.
Yeah. Well, you know, that whole part of my life was a sort of interstitial period between being a graduate student in neuroscience and wanting to become a full-time theoretical neuroscience. And when I was at Berkeley as a graduate student in the late 80s, I was told I really couldn't do what I wanted to do in neuroscience, which was being a theoretician. So I ended up going back in the computing industry for what I thought would be 4 years, just to sort of make some money and get my bearings. And that's when I started Palm. And the funny thing about that, everyone who worked for me for all those years at Palm and Handspring, everybody knew that I really didn't want to be doing that, that I wanted to be studying neuroscience. And that was sort of the cult there. And so that was the plan, to get through that period of my life and come back and be study brains. And that's what happened.
That is what happened.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that, right? So Numenta, this is your current company. You've been through a couple iterations, the Redwood Institute. So Numenta is your current company, and it's a private company, and the primary goal is to reverse engineer the neocortex. And what you guys do, from what I understand, is you are theoreticians, so you study the data that's collected by experimental neuroscientists. You guys study that data, you create the theories, and create predictions that can then be tested again in experimental neuroscience. You want to tell me just a little bit more about it?
Yeah, that's quite right. Although it's funny because in other fields such as physics, there are a lot of theoreticians, theoretical physicists, and they're experimentalists. In the neuroscience world, that's very rare. And in fact, when I got into this field, it was unheard of. You couldn't be a theoretical neuroscientist. That's what I was told.
Right.
You had to work in an experimental lab, and I think you did too in your past, perhaps.
Yes, I look at you, and I'm jealous, and I think you've done it the right way because I spent a lot of hours doing experiments.
Yeah, well, I was a graduate student at Berkeley, and I was looking at these different experimental labs, and I said, this is not going to work for me. This is going to take me years and years and years. I'll be enmeshed in these experimental techniques, and I really want to stick to the high-level theory. And the people who are doing the lab work, it's not a luxury they have typically. And so it's unusual that we have a theoretical group, but it shouldn't be unusual. Other fields of science have theoreticians. And so we play a very traditional role of being a theoretical neuroscientist in that we analyze data, we work with experimental labs, we have a lot of close collaborations, but we don't do the experimental work ourselves. That is unusual in neuroscience, but it's not unusual in science in general.
Yeah.
So it's just the way it turned out, and I had to follow the path that made it work for me.
Yeah. So I mean, it's interesting because we're at a time right now in neuroscience where we're starting to be able to collect larger and larger sets of data. So in a sense, it's really difficult right now to be an experimentalist and a theorist. It's getting harder and harder and harder. So that separation, I think you're going to become a little bit more mainstream, and you're helping to bring that forth as well. So
I think we are pretty mainstream. We're just rare.
Yeah.
As I said, we have a lot of collaborations, and I meet and work with neuroscientists all the time. I've given dozens and dozens of invited talks at different conferences, neuroscience conferences, and so on. And so we're well respected. It's just that we're just a bit unusual.
That's good. That's your tagline.
Yeah.
So who works for you? Like, so what kind of backgrounds do they have? Is it academic backgrounds, experimentalists, industry people?
Well, it's a little bit of a mixture of things. We have an office in Redwood City, California. That's Northern California, just a couple miles from Stanford. And we have, I would say, five sort of technical staff. Several have PhDs, some don't. There's a mixture. When they come into Numenta, they have a mixture of various sorts of technology, machine learning, AI, and neuroscience.
Yeah.
When you spend time here, we all become neuroscientists. We read neuroscience papers all the time. I train new people who, if they don't have the neuroscience, they have to learn it. So we all become experts in the neuroscience if they're not coming in with that knowledge. But so there's like five of us who are sort of the technical staff, and we work together as a team. And then there's about another five people who sort of do other things. There's marketing and office. We have an office manager and our CEO. And so there's various business relationships we maintain and things you have to do when you have a business.
But otherwise, it's kind of the size of a small to medium sized lab.
Exactly. It is. It's kind of a exactly what it is. You could think of me as the PI.
Yep.
Although VP of Research, Subhatai Ahmad, is also he manages everybody. So kind of we're partners in that. So but you can think of it that way. Yeah, it's a small lab or medium sized lab.
A couple episodes ago, I talked with your co-founder, Dilip George. So that was fun. So and he's off doing other things now.
Yeah.
So I guess it's probably worth talking for a moment about the underlying technology that you guys have developed and use, which is called hierarchical temporal memory. Can you give just a broad overview of some of the key properties of HTM, let's say, and maybe in particular the role of sparseness and why it's important?
Yeah. I mean, that's a big topic. We use the term HTM as sort of an umbrella term to refer to our theories about the neocortex. And it's an evolving set of theories, meaning we're adding to it all the time. So when we started using HTM, we had some components in place, and now we have many more components in place.
Right.
So it's not a singular thing. It's all based on essentially having a theoretical theory of how the neocortex operates. And we've made tremendous progress on that literally in the last year, but over the last 6 or 7 years. There are numerous things. You brought up some detail. You mentioned sparseness and sparse coding. That's a core fundamental principle that brains use, is that when you think about a set of neurons and when they want to represent something, the way they represent it is some of the neurons are active, relatively active, and some of them are not. Some of them are firing quickly, some of them are not. We call it a sparse distributed code because if I say I had 10,000 neurons, there may only be 2% active at any point in time, or about 200. And so that's a sparse code, but it's distributed because it's not a grandmother cell. Like, you need 200 cells to represent this thing. And it turns out that the properties of sparse distributed representations, that is, you're representing things by having a population of neurons and a subset of them are active. The mathematical properties that are very interesting, and we've written extensively about this. It explains why neurons, the typical neurons in the brain, have thousands of synapses, what those synapses are doing, how memories are formed, and so on. It's a fairly in-depth topic, but it's core to how the brain works. It's like if computers work on bytes and words and binary words, the brains work on sparse distributed representations. And it's sort of like the fundamental data type. Everything we build on top of that, once you know that, then you can start how you build these circuits and what are they doing and what are the things they're representing. That's sort of like a foundation layer. And then HTM refers in general, it's just, we don't even say hierarchical temporal memory much anymore. We say HTM, but essentially it just reflects the fact that the brain has a hierarchy of regions, the neocortex does, and that the way to think about it, it's a memory system, it's learning things, and it's time-based. You can't really think about the brain acting in a static moment.
Yeah.
It's constantly changing. The inputs to your brain are just changing on the order of tens of milliseconds. Your eyes are moving all the time. My speech is changing on the order of tens of milliseconds right now. So the brain processes time-based data. So it's kind of an umbrella term saying, look, brains are hierarchically structured. They're based on memory. They're based on time. And that's very a generic description. And then the details are what really matter.
Yeah. Okay. So we're gonna talk about your most recent paper, and it's just impossible to really build up to that point, you know, without spending a couple hours probably. So so we're gonna do our best here, but
I think we can do better than that, Paul.
Okay, good. Well, I mean, I know you're a good teacher, so maybe you can help us along here. Let's go back and start about one of the earliest ways that you influenced me, which is your book on intelligence. And I remember reading this on the public buses in Pittsburgh when I was in graduate school. I have very specific memories. I even actually missed my stop one time because I was reading your damn book. You know?
That's good.
Yeah. So, like, roughly speaking, it's kind of built around the work of many people, but in particular Vernon Mountcastle, who proposed that the neocortex is composed of these repeated functional units, the cortical column, and that across all of our cortex, these cortical columns are basically computing the same thing. And if we can understand what that thing is that they're computing, then we can understand the cortex. And what you do is propose that the cortex is making predictions about the world based on comparing what's coming in to the senses and also comparing that with what's stored in our memory. So a prediction is derived from these things, and that these predictions drive what we actually then perceive and how we go about moving through the world. Anything we should add to that? That's kind of a bigger overall picture.
Yeah, I think that's right. I would use slightly different language today. Today, people would say, and I say too, that the brain learns a predictive model of the world.
Yeah.
I don't think I use that particular phrase in the book, but that's what I was talking about. And so the idea is that, you know, if for a long time, people thought of the brain as like an input-output processor. You put in some sensory data and you get some action. And many people, including myself, and when I wrote the book, this is the topic of the book, was like, no, that's not right. The way to think about the brain is it learns a model of the world. It's a very detailed model of the world. There's a incredible number of things you and I have learned in our lifetime. And that model, when you have sensory input comes in, it invokes the model, and the model makes predictions about what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
And those predictions can be at the very low level, like what I'm going to feel when I put my hand on the desk or touch my coffee cup or move my eyes. And it could be at a very high level, like what's going to happen if I do this podcast with you, and what might its effects be. And so that's the way, and I was arguing on intelligence that we need to think about the brain as this sort of memory or predictive, this memory-based model of the world, and how that's a great way of attacking the problem, asking how can you build a model and how can that model make predictions. And that's essentially the research paradigm we followed at Namenta, is to say, how does the neocortex build a model of the world? How does it make predictions about future events? That's a sort of a constraint on the model, and says, okay, you know, we can ask, how do neurons make predictions? We actually, in our 2016 paper, which was titled Why Neurons Have Thousands of Synapses, we introduce a major new theory about that there's an internal sort of depolarization state of neurons in the cortex, which represents a predictive state.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of influenced our thinking all along. But the simple way, if you're new to this, the neuroscience, just think about this. When you're born, you really don't know about anything. You don't know about buildings and cars and trees and computers. You don't know about any words. You don't know any particular language. You don't know about the continents or the countries and so on. You have to learn all this stuff, and it's stored in your neocortex, and you build this model of the world. The model is in the stored in your neocortex, and question is, how do you learn that model? How is it represented in neurons? And then, you know, how does it work? And that, in a nutshell, is what I was arguing in On Intelligence. That's what we ought to study, and that's what we do. And our most recent paper, the one that this was posted a couple of weeks ago, that really gets at the core of this. We think we figured out the key ingredient here. We think we've broken the code on this, but it's all been in the same vein. So On Intelligence was sort of like, hey, here's what we should be doing, and so here's what I'm going to do for the next 10 years. and by the way, a lot of people had, you know, a lot of people love that book. It influenced quite a few people.
Oh, it really did, and I really think that it's a great primer. It's really engrossing, and it's convincing, and it's really well written. And I really think it's a great primer for just the series of studies that you've done leading up to the one we're going to talk about.
It is. I should just mention in completing this, if the book is well written, I'm going to give credit to Sandra Blakeslee, who is a professional. She is a science writer, and she basically helped me make the book readable, more readable than I would have. She's listed on the book. I just want to point out that that was one of the things I wrote that book. I said, you know what, I really want to make this readable, and I want it to be a great book. and I think I'm a pretty good writer, but I know that I'm not a professional writer. And so I engaged her to help me do that. Anyway, so
that's great.
Yeah.
Is there anything that if someone reads it today, is there anything you feel like you got wrong in the book, or if you rewrote it, would there be a major directional shift or anything?
No, I don't think so. I did read the book again like a year ago, and I wasn't looking forward to it. I was cringing about it, you know. I was like, oh my God, how's it going to be, you know? And it was pretty good.
Yeah.
I have to admit, oh, there's some things I got wrong in there, sure, small things. But I think in overall, the tone and the basic message is still correct. I am writing a new book. I've started it. It's sort of a follow-on, but it basically says, okay, in the last 12 years or whatever it's been, we've made a huge amount of progress on this thing, and I want to tell people about it. We have really cracked the code on this, and it's very exciting, and it's going to take me a while to explain it to everybody, and we're working on it in different ways. So I want to rewrite the book, not to correct anything, but just to say, hey, listen, we've made a lot of progress here.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about it.
Well, let's talk about it. Let's talk about it now. So you're here to talk about your most recent work, the most recent paper, which really just came out recently.
Yeah, like a week ago. But it's by the way, it's on a preprint server, so we've submitted it for publication. I'm sure it'll get published but we don't know when it actually will get to peer review, but it will.
Yeah, it's in BioArchive right now, and
BioArchive, yeah.
Yeah, I'll link to it in the show notes. But so it's called A Framework for Intelligence and Cortical Function Based on Grid Cells in the Neocortex. And this is just built on layer of your previous work. Now, because this is a podcast, I want to keep it as high level as possible, but yeah. I know that we need to dig in a little bit and make the high level understandable. So let me do my best to quickly recap what's led up to this, and then you can do your thing, okay?
Okay, sure.
Okay, so you guys really quickly had written 5 papers on how cortical columns can learn sequences. Predictive models of the sequences. Then you moved on to doing the same sort of thing, but with sensorimotor sequences. So now we're dealing with locations and movement. So you bring that into the fore. Then you take another leap, and you theorize that one way to accomplish this was if the cortex or cortical columns contained something like a type of cell found in the hippocampus called a grid cell that's known to encode an animal's location in the environment. And I should say in all these theories, you map the processes onto specific layers in the cortical columns. So you keep it very biologically plausible. And now we come to the current work with the 1,000 Brains Theory of Intelligence and this framework that we'll discuss. So maybe you can take a second to expand on that very understated summary of mine and then talk about what's new with what we're...
You know. Yeah, I think that was a good summary, Paul. Let me just... try to say it in a slightly different way.
Yep.
If you imagine your brain or your neocortex is in your head, and there's several million fibers coming from your sensory organs. There's about 1 million from your eyes and about 1 million from your body, and there's about 30,000 from your ears. And these patterns are changing all the time, as we mentioned earlier. They're constantly changing. And you just imagine it's like a flood of changing, bum, 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 bum. And the brain has to make sense of this. And there's two reasons the reasons these inputs might be changing. One is that the world is changing. So right now, your listeners could be sitting perfectly still, and my voice is creating this changing stream of data coming into their brain, into your brain. The other reason is that we move. That I imagine if I go to a house and there's nobody in the house, I'm learning this house for the first time. Well, as I walk around the house, the inputs to my brain are changing, but it's because I'm moving. I'm picking things up. I'm turning my head. So you can think about if we want to build a predictive model of the world, we broke it into these two parts. The easier part was what we call sequence memory. It's like, okay, I'm going to listen to a melody, and how do I learn the melody? How am I going to make predictions about it? That's where the world is changing. The vast majority of the time, the inputs to the brain are changing because we move. Hmm. And that's a much more difficult problem, but it's a related problem. So we tackle the first one, the sequence memory. Then we started thinking about how it is we build this sensory motor, as you used the term earlier, a sensory motor model of the world. And that was much more challenging. And it took us a while until we figured out this sort of trick that we think the brain is doing. And that's related to the grid cells, that we realize that that everywhere in the brain, everywhere in your neocortex, everywhere throughout the neocortex, there are cells that must be representing a location. And the location is it's kind of interesting how they do this, but it's a location relative to other things.
Right.
So if I'm looking at a door, there are cells in my visual cortex that represent the location of features on the door relative to the door. It's like if I could put some sort of reference frame around the door. And then once we realized this was a novel idea, as far as we know, we don't think anyone else had really realized this was going on in the neocortex. Once we realized that this location signal was pervasive, then all kinds of things fell into place. And we could say, oh, my God, we understand how it does this and how it does this and how it does this. And then we said, how could the brain represent location? It's a very odd thing. How could neurons know, where something is relative to something else out in the world out there? And that's when we had the idea that let's go look at grid cells because as you mentioned, grid cells are in the hippocampal complex. They're actually in a part of the brain called the entorhinal cortex, which is part of the hippocampal complex.
Right.
But it's an older part of the brain. It's small. In a human, it might be about the size of your pinky. And those cells, which have been very well studied, as you said, they represent location. They represent the location of my body or anybody's body relative to the room you're in or the environment you're in.
Mm-hmm.
We said, oh, nature figured this out a long time ago, figured out how to represent where you are in the world. You need that for navigation. We said maybe the cortex is using the same thing. And maybe those grid cells are also now in the neocortex. And we're pretty certain that's the case. And so that was like, that leads us up there. So all of a sudden we have like the brain is just like everyone thought about it, but now we have this entire new functionality that's going on everywhere, which is this location processing.
Something appealing about this idea also is that the brain is not known to reinvent new structures and things. So it builds upon what it has already. So it's appealing in that sense that something older evolutionarily would then get repurposed and maybe changed a little bit, but repurposed in the neocortex as well.
Yeah. In fact, these grid cell mechanisms are very complex. They're very kind of clever.
Mm-hmm.
And so my thinking is, and this is speculation, that these were evolved over many, many, you know, long before humans and even probably even before mammals, but maybe certainly early mammals. And so we had to figure out how to get around the world. And that was something they had to do from a long time ago. And so there's been under a lot of evolutionary pressure to figure out how to figure out where you are in the world. And now what the neocortex does, it says, oh, yeah, look at that. That's a great algorithm. I'm going to use it for something else, just like you said. In the paper, we have a figure, and I'll try to paint it for your listeners. We show a rat moving around in a room. And this is the kind of things that neuroscientists study when they study grid cells. And the grid cells help the rat make a map of the room and learn where things are in the room. And so, and you do this too. So when you walk into your house or your office, you know where things are and you recognize it. That's all happening in the grid cells. And what then we said, look, the same thing's happening in the neocortex, but instead of your body moving around in the room, imagine the finger, your finger. Your finger has a sensory organ, and it's touching things. Well, when you touch things with your finger, it's moving around objects. It's like it's building a map of an object by touching it in different locations. And so just like the body moving around in the room, your sensory organs, whether it's your retina or your finger, are moving around objects. And they're learning to make a map of the object in the same way that the entorhinal cortex learns maps of rooms. It's a very analogous situation. But of course, we can do this for all different parts of my body. So I can do it with my hands, my feet, my legs, my eyes, my ears, and so on. So the cortex basically took that algorithm that evolved a long time ago for navigation and mapping of environments and said, oh, I can learn structures of objects in the world and where they are and what they look like.
Yeah, very good. So a couple things that in this paper that were already known and have been sort of repurposed, and like grid cells, like we've just been talking about, and a few things that are new and proposed as theoretical. One is that cortical columns learn complete objects. They don't learn features necessarily. Like each cortical column learns it's a complete object within it. Two, that there are grid cells all over the cortex because they are in every cortical column. And three, you guys propose the existence of a new type of cell called a displacement cell.
Yes.
That are also in every cortical column and all over the cortex, therefore. So do you want to just expound on those a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Well, the order is slightly different. First, we said, oh, there must be grid cells throughout the neocortex. And then once you realize that, then you say, oh, if there are, then every column can learn complete models of objects. And then when we said, oh, if they're learning complete models of objects, we deduce there must be this thing called the displacement cell. Well, let me just break that down a little bit. So the grid cells are very well known. They're studied. The Mosers got a Nobel Prize for their discovery. And originally we thought the proposal that there are grid cells throughout the neocortex was going to be completely novel. But it turns out there's some people who have been observing this. I don't think anyone said, oh, they're everywhere. But people have been seeing evidence for them in certain parts of the neocortex. And we would have predicted that. But so there's experimental evidence supporting that. So what we were saying is it's everywhere. That's perhaps the new thing there.
Yep.
And then as far as we know, no one, the displacement cell thing is completely novel. It's funny, some people say, well, there's no evidence for that. Well, that's what theoreticians are supposed to do. We're supposed to propose things that no one has seen before. And so I'm very confident that they're going to be found. And so to me, that's, some people think of it as very speculative. I think of just the opposite. This is a bold prediction.
It is.
And so it's If someone said, oh, well, look, we found grid cells everywhere in the neocortex, people might say, yeah, well, other people might have been seeing them, so that's not such a big deal. But this is something that no one's ever thought about. So this will be like, okay, when we find them, that'll be sort of a nice thing. But we deduced it. You can deduce the presence of these. By the way, I should mention that one of our scientists, Marcus Lewis, was the guy who originally came up with that idea of displacement cells. We had been working on a particular problem, and he came up with that solution, which is very nice. It's great that we can propose things that we're pretty confident that exist and that no one else had thought about before. And so when they're discovered or not, then that'll either support the theory or falsify it.
I mean, if you had to guess right now, you like speculation, and we like it here on this show, so this is good. So what proportion of neurons, like within a given cortical column, do you think are devoted, or are these grid cells and displacement cells?
Okay, well, let me paint a picture for your listeners. If you took a square millimeter of cortex of human neocortex, so you have a square millimeter and maybe 2.5 millimeters thick, that cuts across all the layers. There's about 100,000 neurons, roughly, in that square millimeter. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of neurons. And you can break it down somewhere. You could say, argue there's maybe 6 layers or 10 layers, depending on how you look at it. Let's just say we break into 10 layers. That means there's 10,000 neurons per each layer of cells, a different type of cell types. These are all rough numbers.
Yep.
And so if I were to say, how much is dedicated to grid cells, you might say, well, one of those layers. So it might be in a square millimeter of cortex, there might be several thousand to 10,000 cells that represent the grid cells. And there might be similar sort of, several thousand to 10,000 neurons that represent the displacement cells. Those are we're talking very rough numbers. It's not hundreds of thousands. It's not 10, but that gives you sort of a flavor for it. And these numbers, we're always testing these numbers against both the theory, like how many neurons do you need to do these things, and also with what's experimental empirical evidence about, like, what do we know about grid cells? How dense are they in the entorhinal cortex? How many are there? And things like that. So we're constantly testing these ideas. And those are all copacetic. So that gives you a flavor. Maybe 1/10 of the neurons in the cortex are related specifically to this location stuff.
Do you propose experiments to people? Because they're, when I retired from neuroscience, we were able to, even at that time, which was not long ago, but you can get into a layer specific. You kind of know where you are within a layer of a cortex. So you could really target these things with electrodes, for instance.
Yeah. So here's how it works. We do propose experiments, but it's very dependent on whose lab we're talking
to. Sure,
Every lab has their own experimental techniques. Some are using probes, tetrodes. Some are using optical imaging. Some are using fMRI. Some have different experimental animals. Some are using humans and so on. And so you can't just blankly say, here's an experiment. You have to sit down with the research team and say, what does your lab do? What do you guys, and let's come up with an experiment that makes sense for what you guys do. And so that's how we go about it. There are many, many testable predictions in our work.
Right.
And we have numerous collaborations and numerous conversations all the time with people about how to test these things. And of course, as you know, these experiments are very difficult to do. If you want to do even something on a rodent, you might spend a year getting ready to do your experiment.
Right.
A year just getting ready to do it. Then another year collecting your data, hoping the animals don't all die and, something bad doesn't happen. So it's a multi-year effort. So it's not something for us to just come drop in one day and say, hey, test this. You have to be sensitive where they are. What we found sometimes is even more successful is that a lot of experimentalists have data they've collected in the past. And we can go back to that pre-existing data and look for things they didn't know that they had.
Yeah.
And that's quicker because there's no new experiments required. You can say, okay, we predict we'll find the following things in your data. And that's been a fruitful method for us.
Well, okay, so let's talk just a couple minutes more about the sort of the features or the fallout from the theories, right? So one of the things is that you propose that every cortical column across the cortex codes for an entire object, right?
Yeah.
In the paper, you talk about how objects are made up of sort of sub-objects. You use the example of a coffee mug. It's a handle and a cup and sometimes a logo and things like that.
Yeah.
And so presumably each of these, I keep wanting to say features, but sub-objects of the object.
Yes, that's right. It's objects of objects.
Would a more complex object that has more sub-objects, would that require more cortical resources then?
Actually, almost the opposite. It's, first of all, we just have to recognize the world is structured this way. I mean, the world is structured of things made of things made of things made of things. you take a car, and you can and you identify dozens of subcomponents to that car, doors and handles and wheels and hubcaps and hoods and so on. Each of those is subcomponents. And so the world is structured this way. And when we want to learn something new, you don't want to learn everything new again. You basically want to say, oh, this is like something else. It's got these components arranged in this way. And so the brain must do this. This is not an option. The brain has to build a model of the world. It knows what cars are. It knows what computers are. It knows all these things. It knows how they work. This is all in your head. And so the neurons must represent this structure. And not many people think along these lines, at least when it comes to neuroscience. But so the question is, how do neurons represent this sort of object of objects structure? And this is a problem I identified a long time ago. I said, oh my gosh, the neurons have to do this. It seems really hard to imagine how they do this. So we've been thinking about it for a long time and for years. And just about a year ago, after we started understanding the true nature of grid cells and how they work and the inner workings of grid cells, then we came up with this displacement cell idea, which says, oh, displacement cells can represent that structure of structure. Mm-hmm. And they can do it very efficiently. This is the key thing about it. In the paper, I mentioned this, but I'll just give you some numbers on it. You know, let's say I want, in the paper, we talk about a coffee cup and a logo. And we say, okay, there's a logo. We use the Memento logo because we have rights to that.
We'll use a brain-inspired logo for this one.
Okay, yeah. Okay, fine. Yeah, great. Yeah. And say, okay, so I've learned a logo. I know that. And I have this coffee cup, and I know that. I want to learn a new object, which is the cup with a logo. I don't want to relearn either of those things. Mm-hmm. I just want to somehow say there's a new object to compose the previously learned objects. And the displacement cells, through a trick, which we won't be able to describe on the air here.
Right.
The displacements do this extremely efficiently. I mean, I'm not joking here. It might be as simple as the activity of 20 neurons or maybe 50 neurons that can represent a new object, which is composed of the logo and the coffee cup.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an extremely efficient methodology for building complex structures. And so you say, does it need more neurons? Yes, well, we need neurons to represent this, but it's far more efficient than if I said, okay, here's a new object. Let's remember every feature at every location for this new object. You know, if I can build a new composite object using 100 active neurons, you know, in a population of, say, several thousand, if I can remember that new structure that efficiently in one fell swoop, in essence, in one moment of perception, that's an extremely efficient from a learning point of view and a storage point of view.
And well, it's also, we're not talking about 20 separate distinct neurons, right? Because these can be overlapping populations.
Yeah, exactly. So imagine I'm on a cortical column and we have these, our proposed displacement cells. Maybe I have 10,000 displacement cells and 200 are active at a time. Well, there's almost an incredibly, almost infinite, or bigger than the universe number of ways you can pick 200 cells out of 10,000. So we have a very large representational capacity. And so even that one column can learn thousands and thousands and thousands of composite objects.
Hmm.
The numbers are surprising how much capacity there is in these sparse representations. And most people just don't think along these lines. Most people think like, you know, a region of the cortex is just doing some sort of filter and passing information on someplace else. And we're saying, no, these things are incredibly powerful. And in hindsight, if you think the brain has to know this stuff, where is it going to store it? You know, we kind of think like, oh, somewhere up in the higher level in the hierarchy, some prefrontal lobe thing. Well, the prefrontal lobe looks like everything else. So it makes sense that everything is sort of stored everywhere. That's a much more copacetic philosophy. It's not that the neocortex is completely uniform. Not everything learns everything, but everything is able to learn some structure in the world.
So we know the brain is hierarchical, and the common understanding these days is that processing along the hierarchy goes from sort of simple lower level features like edges, line detectors, to abstract features like whole objects, etc. So how does this framework compare to what's generally accepted about hierarchy in the brain now?
Yeah, sure. So it's more like that's an incomplete picture. It's not completely wrong, but it's really incomplete. So first of all, if you actually look at the wiring of the neocortex, you know, the white matter, how regions project to each other, it doesn't look like a regular hierarchy. It looks really messy. And what, you know, connections are going all over the place. It's like doesn't really fit the description of a nice hierarchy. Even the first paper published on this back in 1991 by Thelemann and Vanessen, they made this famous picture of the monkey's brain, how it, all the different regions are connected. And even back then, they said, looks like basically half of all the possible connections in the brain exist, which is incredibly overconnected. So it's not, shouldn't be a surprise when we say that the brain is not strictly hierarchical, because it doesn't look that way.
Sure.
And then the second thing is when people observe neurons, if you go back to in the 60s, these two famous neuroscientists, Hubel and Wiesel, and they won a Nobel Prize for their work, they were basically using anesthetized cats. And so the cat was not awake, and they would try to get these cells to respond, and they said, well, it looks like these cells respond to these simple features. We now know that in an awake animal who's actually moving around in the world,
yeah.
Those cells don't look like that at all. They seem to have very different response properties. So this idea that there's these simple feature extractors goes back 50 years, and it's based on the experimental paradigm of an anesthetized animal. And we now know that that's not what it looks like. So there's a lot of data which does not support the idea that there's this hierarchical feature extraction thing, and people just haven't abandoned it yet. And our theory explains all this stuff. It explains why these cells behave weirdly. We talk about this in some of our papers. And so we're introducing this idea that, look, a single cortical column, whether it's in the primary sensory region that's getting your input from your eyes or ears or something high level, is able to learn complete models of objects. And it's a very sophisticated processor. They all can't learn the same things. Like a part of your visual cortex can only learn models based on visual input. It can only learn models based on some part of your visual input. And then the thousand brains theory, which we've labeled this, is that you've got thousands of these models. If I'm looking at a coffee cup and I'm touching a coffee cup, I have tactile models of the coffee cup. I have visual models of the coffee cup. All these are running in parallel in different cortical columns, and they vote. And so many of these long range connections can be understood as them all voting. It's like if you and I were looking at the same object, but neither one of us could be certain what it was. And I say, you know, Paul, I think it might be a coffee cup, or it might be a soda can, or it might be a handheld computer. And you say, well, you know, I think it might be a tennis ball or a soda can or, you know, a chair. And then we say, well, let's vote. And then we go, oh, I guess it's a soda can. So it's something like that. So it's a very different view. Instead of some of this pyramid of information coming up to some one big model of the world, the cortex is actually thousands and thousands of models, and all running in parallel, and they're voting all the time. It's a completely different flip in how you think about it. And I'm very confident that this is actually what's going on. And it doesn't mean that there isn't hierarchy. There's still, like, some models become inputs to other models. Mm-hmm. But it's not like there's feature extraction and then you get to one model. It's like there's models and models and models all over the place.
The examples that you give and what we've mostly been talking about are visual and or tactical. So it's easy to kind of think of how this would work, how the framework would encompass these things in location-based coding, right? It's a little more difficult to think about how it might apply to other cognitive abilities like language and math. So yeah. How do we conceptualize that?
Sure. Well, let's just start with some physical evidence. We mentioned Vernon Mountcastle earlier, and he said every part of the cortex is doing the same thing, and it looks that way. The circuitry looks the same way, and all the circuitry we've proposed for the for visual and somatosensory cortex, it looks the same everywhere. So the evidence would suggest that however these cortical columns are working in vision and touch, they're working in language areas and high-level thought. So if just on that pure physical evidence, if we said, okay, the cortex works on location spaces, well, then language must work on location spaces too. So we can just start with that as a walking in assumption. Now, let's just take language, for example. We haven't focused on this part, but there's some interesting, intriguing ideas. Take these displacement cells we propose. They represent the relationship of an object to another object. And one of the things you can do with them is you can create recursive or reentrant structures this way. Like I can say, here's a coffee cup with a logo, and the logo has a coffee cup, and the coffee cup has a logo. It's like a nested structure, right? And you think about language, much of language is this sort of recursive and reentrant structures. You have objects and actions related to other objects and actions, and there's nested structures in language and so on. So there's a hint there that, hey, you know, this basic idea of representing things in sort of relationship to other things and relationship to other things in a sort of recursive form could form the basis of language, which is very, I think it's going to turn out to be true. There's some studies that have been done using humans who are doing sort of mental imagery tasks.
Yeah.
And these are sort of high level thinking and thoughts. And what they've shown using some clever imaging techniques, fMRI techniques on humans doing these mental tasks, is that there appear to be that when we think about these high level tasks, we assign objects in location spaces that they can demonstrate this. I won't explain how, but it's clever. They can show that when we think about structures, mental structures of things in the world, we kind of locate them in a framework that's like a physical, it's almost like a physical framework, but it's not. It's a mental framework that's sort of like a location space. So this is an area that that it's going to be fascinating to pursue. But I'm very confident that all high-level thought can be understood in this location space using grid cells. And even though we don't really understand it very well yet, it gives us an ability to say, look, it's going to be like this. So now we have a hook to go into these things and start thinking more about, like, okay, how is language going to be represented? No one knows right now. No one has any idea how the cortex does language.
Yeah.
And now I have a framework that says, look, I think it's going to work under these principles. It's going to work just like this, and the columns in the parts of the brain that do language are going to work on these principles. So let's figure out how language maps onto them. That's exciting. That's a very exciting thing for me.
I think it's exciting too. It's intuitively appealing as well, and like a good theory should, it really opens up doors to new ways of thought about approaching all different levels of cognitive capacity.
Yeah. That's why we labeled our paper a framework.
Yeah.
For cortical theory or cortical function is because it's very broad, and I can't say I have a theory of language or I have a theory of this.
Right.
But I have a framework by which you can understand these things, and the framework is novel and it's really interesting. And once you get it, and people are getting it, it's like, oh my God, this is incredible. Maybe this could explain everything. Maybe we'll see.
Yeah. Good. Explain. That'll be the title of the next book or paper. This explains everything.
No, yeah. You can't say that.
Well, so we didn't touch on everything that's in the paper. So I strongly recommend people look up the paper or just go to the notes.
You can just go to thementa.com and we have all these resources listed there, including a companion guide to the paper. So if you're not comfortable reading neuroscience papers, they can be daunting. You can read the companion first. It sort of explains it in lay terms.
So keep up the good work. I don't need to tell you that because you are going to forge ahead no matter what anybody says, which is great. So we have just a few more minutes here. I'm wondering if I can ask you some sort of broad and speculative and general questions.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Okay. One of the things that you are really well known for is demonstrating our cortex. You bring out a dinner napkin and you say it's about the size of a dinner napkin. So do you have it on you? There it is. Okay. So the question is, how often does that thing get washed?
Well, actually, I've had different ones.
Oh, okay. Oh, sure, so sure.
I recently switched to this one because it's kind of like a gray-green color, which is more sort of brain colorish.
Oh, nice.
It doesn't have the red for the blood in it. It doesn't get washed very often. I don't think I've ever washed this, but then again, I don't use it that often.
Well, it's in your talks a lot, right?
It's in my talk, but I never wipe anything with it. It's like I take it out and I put it away again.
Yeah, so that's right. That's right.
I suppose I should wash it, but it's not like it's been sitting around the dinner table, you know?
Right.
It's kept in my bag or on someplace, but interesting question.
When are you going to learn how to fold that thing into a folded cortex?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because if you actually took the neocortex out of your head, you can't actually iron it flat. It's
right.
Like a globe. You can't take a globe and iron it flat. It's a rough idea. What the great thing about the napkin is that people realize that thing, which is only that big, is you.
Right.
And in there is everything you've ever learned and everything you've ever known and every experience is in that little sheet. And it's kind of looking at it. It's like, oh my God, that's me, huh?
Yeah, it's powerful. Yeah. So actually two episodes ago, rather, I had Terry Sanofsky on the show. And he talked about this being a golden era of neuroscience, that when people look back, and this is a guy who's been working on this for a long time.
Yeah.
Because we have lots of data pouring in. And we have a lot more computational ability. And, you know, he works a lot with the deep learning and other AI techniques. So with all the data coming in, we can soon start to really test these frameworks and theories that are being proposed, like people like you. So do you think that this will be seen as the golden era?
I like Terry. He's a friend of mine. I have a slightly different take on what that is.
Mm-hmm.
We've been collecting lots of data for a long, long time.
Right.
I mean, we had lots of data in the 1970s. We had lots of data in the 1980s. We had lots of data, you know, there's always been more data that has been, tons of data that has been unassimilated into theory. And we are now collecting at an even faster rate. But my attitude has been the data itself isn't going to give you an answer. What we've been lacking is sort of a theoretical framework in which to interpret these things. That was true back in the 70s. I read an article by Francis Crick in 1979 that basically launched my career in neuroscience.
Yeah.
And Francis Crick said, we are lacking a theoretical framework. We don't, you know, more data is not going to help. So that's what got me going. So, you know, to me, it'll become a golden era in neuroscience if these frameworks are correct. And for example, like if the work we are doing right now, if that turns out to be correct, that will begin a golden era of neuroscience. If we don't have a theoretical framework that understand, then we're just going to have to be swimming in data. And we've been swimming in data for years. So to me, the golden era of neuroscience is when we go from being a pre-paradigm science, and this is in the language of Thomas Kuhn, the historian, we go from being a pre-paradigm science to a post-paradigm science. Like, we just have a whole bunch of data. We have no idea what the hell's going on. To like, now we understand what's happening. We can start really attacking this problem in a logical way. We have not been doing that. That's not where neuroscience is.
Hmm.
Neuroscience is a lot of data with really almost no theoretical understanding. The only place we've had real success, one of the few places we've had real success in the mammalian brain, is in the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex, because there's some real theories there. And we're trying to bring that same sort of level of understanding to the neocortex.
Okay, so Rudolfo Lenas, I think is how you pronounce his name, and
yeah.
Daniel Wolpert, they have these ideas that evolutionarily, the way our thought came about is by sort of internalizing movements, and how important movement has been to early, you know, since single-celled organisms up evolving through humans, let's say. And that virtually all cognition is rooted in movements. And this is a little bit related to your work, because you have to move your finger to understand the object, to get the location-based framework going on in your cortical columns. So do you agree with that idea, or what's your
Yeah, I do. I do. I'm not intimately familiar with what they argued, so I'm not saying I agree with everything they
right.
say, because I'd rather know. But at the level you just described, I totally agree. You cannot understand the brain, and you cannot build intelligent machines that have any sort of embodiment. The way you learn the structure of the world is through movement. And there's an interesting twist on this in a moment, but let's just follow through on this. Everywhere in the neocortex, everywhere that we've looked, every column has a motor output. This is a surprising result. No one anticipated this many years ago. But even primary visual cortex, the columns there project to the part of the brain that moves the eyes. So there's even auditory cortex projects to the part of the brain that orients your head. So the idea that you can perceive the world and learn the world without movement is just nonsense. You have to move. And so we think about the future of AI. I think robotics and AI cannot be separated. They're not separate problems. They're one and the same problem.
Hmm.
Now, let's just step back a second and say movement does not have to be physical movement. You don't have to.
Right.
What's important is you have to move your senses and experience something, to experience another structure in the world. So when we sit and do mathematics and we're manipulating equations and structures in our head, you can do that completely mentally, but I'm still manipulating these structures in my head. I'm trying to visualize them and how they look in different directions. There's an internal movement command that is, or like you can think of like a mathematical operator. If I multiply, or if I apply a Fourier transform, that's like a movement. It's like, take this data and act upon it. So I think they're right that you cannot separate out movement and sensation, and that all cognition is based on movement. And when we interact with the world through our hands and our eyes, we have to physically move. But internally, once you get to higher levels of the cortex, movements can be more abstract, and you don't have to be physical about it, but the same principles apply.
I know that we have to move on here because we're up against time, so I have one more quick question for you. When will we know what we mean when we say consciousness?
Oh, gosh. I try to avoid the word consciousness. It's just a swamp of I don't know. You know, to me, there was a really smart thing that the people who study consciousness said a long time ago. They said, "Oh, this is the hard problem. How the brain works is the easy problem.
Yeah.
Consciousness is the hard problem." I said, "Well, that was a brilliant marketing move on their part." I say to them, "Look, understanding how the brain works is a hard problem. And there's tens of thousands of neuroscientists around the world working on it all the time. And we've yet to solve that problem. Numenta is working on it. We think we've made some significant progress. And consciousness to me is like, well, it's really even harder to define. What is the problem you're trying to describe?" And they can't describe it very well. So to me, I wrote about this in Non-Intelligence. I made an equation. I said, you know, consciousness can be equivalent to awareness. And I said, if I could turn your brain back to this morning and you were unaware of everything you did, you would claim that you weren't conscious. And so I'm arguing that consciousness is very much related to your ability to recall your experiences. If you can't recall your experiences, you'd say you were unconscious. You had no recollection of it. And it can be as simple as that. And people make it into much more than that. I'll really bother or piss off some people who study consciousness by saying this. So let's just leave it out of the picture. Our focus is on how the brain works, how to build machines that work that way. That's a great problem. And if we solve that problem, we can all go home happy. We don't have to worry about consciousness at the moment. Let's just focus on the real problem we know we have to solve. It's like, how does this brain work?
This is a great place to end it. Jeff, thanks for all your work. And guys, go to numenta.com to learn more about Jeff and learn and download all the papers that are they're all available to download and read. So appreciate your time, Jeff.
I appreciate the interview, Paul. It was great. It was a great interview. And you have a really nice podcast. So honored to be on it.
You gotta love that confidence, the confidence of a theoretical neuroscientist. I wish Jeff all the luck, and I think that what he is doing is super exciting, and I would love to do that myself. Thanks for listening to the show. I hope that you are doing interesting and enjoyable things. Speaking of interesting, next week I am speaking with Julie Grouillet, I believe is how you pronounce it, and her amazing coupled spin-twerk nano-oscillators that she's formed into a neural network. Super interesting, and I'll have to ask her next week if it is enjoyable. Yeah, it's going to be fun. See you next time.